Buonasera, sono molto contento di questa opportunità di partecipare per la prima volta al Festival della Mente. Ringrazio gli organizzatori del Festival, ringrazio tutti quelli tra voi che si sono messi in comunicazione con questa forma di contatto che prelude, spero, a altri incontri un pochino più ravvicinati. Il tema che ci è stato proposto parte dalla dichiarazione di indipendenza degli Stati Uniti, i diritti inalienabili di vita, libertà e soprattutto ricerca della felicità, e questa idea dell'American Dream, del sogno americano, che dà forma a tanta parte dell'immaginazione e del discorso politico negli Stati Uniti. Io mi chiamo Alessandro Portelli, insegnavo letteratura angloamericana all'Università La Sapienza a Roma e sono qui con un piacere immenso con la professoressa Jill Lepore, che è dell'Università di Harvard, che ha appena scritto un libro che spero che nessuno si offenda se ve lo faccio vedere. Si chiama Questa è Verità ed è una storia degli Stati Uniti d'America molto leggibile e penso che dalle idee di questo libro, di tutta questa sua ricerca, possiamo cominciare. So, okay, Jill, you have the floor.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for being here with me, even in this virtual world. So I'm fascinated by thinking about the story of America as the story of the American dream. It's actually a term, that expression, the American dream, is only about a century old. A guy in 1931, guy wrote a history of the United States. This guy's name was James Truslow Adams, and he wanted to call his book The American Dream. And so it's 1931, the Great Depression. Democracy was under siege around the world, and he wrote a history of the United States that was meant to celebrate the idea of America. And when he told his publisher he wanted to call the book The American Dream, his publisher said, "What the hell is that? We're living in a nightmare." And refused to let him call the book The American Dream. So the book is called The Epic of America, this guy Adams's book from 1931. But that's where the expression comes from. It comes from his book, where he was trying to kind of inoculate Americans against the idea that the United States was falling apart and would follow Germany and Italy into fascism, because it had this powerful romantic dream, that anyone could come to this country and rise to success and a life of prosperity and freedom and equality. It's fun to talk about this book with an Italian audience. My family came from Italy. My grandparents came in the 19-teens and early 1920s, and my father was born in 1924, and they're very much seeking that American dream. My father's nickname, his middle name was Amerigo, because he was the first person in our family born in America. So I'm really kind of interested in that romance and that story of America, but that's not what my book is. My history of the United States is quite a different account of the nation's history. We in the United States today are engaged in a very monumental political battle about the future of the country, but it has a corresponding battle that's going on about the past of the country, partly through, well, largely through the Black Lives Matter movement, and the way in which that protest movement asks Americans to reckon with the history of inequality and racial injustice, and conquest that is part of the history of the United States. We have had in the United States a kind of dueling pair of accounts of the history of the nation. On the one hand, there's a story of America that is told, that we associate with the political right, that is about American history as a march of progress and freedom in the United States and around the world, in which everything the United States does is a triumph. And then on the other end of the political spectrum, on the left, we have an account of the nation's past, that is really a series of atrocities. From conquest to enslavement to segregation, to continuing economic inequality, to sins committed by the United States around the world. I wanted to write a book that rejected both of those extreme accounts of the United States, which really are political arguments, they're politics by other means, and try to come up with a newer and fresher account of the nation's past that understood that there's truth in both of those accounts, but that history is an act of inquiry, and in a democracy, one thing that citizens are obligated to do is come to terms with the nation's past. So that's the way I wrote the book.
Well, thank you. Of course, I like the idea that there was a controversy over the title of Adam's book between The Dream and the Nightmare. Of course, this is the title of a classic book by James Cone, Malcolm, Martin in America, A Dream or a Nightmare. Mm-hmm. And the question I've been kind of toying with is, are these two separate accounts, two parallel accounts? Because parallel accounts never meet. And in other words, does the nature of the nightmare have to do with the fact that you're living in a dream? And does the nature of the dream change meaning because of the nightmare? In other words, a number of images have been crowding in my mind these days. I've been thinking of course, Langston Hughes, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it sag? Does it explode? And it looks like it places it's exploding. I've been thinking of course, is a dream a lie if it don't come true? Or is it something worse, Bruce Springsteen, which rhymes with curse? But perhaps my favorite image is from The Day of the Locust, Nathaniel West, where the image of the painting that the author is planning, it's called The Burning of Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has been burning often. Faye is a naked girl in the left foreground being chased by the group of men and women who have separated from the main body of the mob. And the book ends with the mob taking over and burning indeed the city. This is a great image of the pursuit of happiness. It's always there, but you never can... You can't get no satisfaction, and you can't get hold of it. And also, and this generates parts of the nightmare, because it's always there. It's always on offer. It's always enhanced, vitamins added, and it's always beyond your reach. I think this is what changes the meaning of both. On the one hand, you couldn't have the dream without the conquest, without the genocide of the natives, without this is a point that Toni Morrison makes in Playing in the Dark. You can't have the dream without the nightmare. On the other hand, I'm thinking of Martin Luther King when he says, we've come here to cash a check that was given to us by our founding fathers. That is, Martin was living the nightmare, but the meaning of the nightmare and the way out of the nightmare was somehow indicated by the dream. So I wonder if there is, rather than to parallel stories, they're just one story of tensions, of conflict, rather than just a great epic with some problems or a nightmare with a tension between, in which the meaning of each word is redefined by the presence of its opposite.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it. I don't think that they are separate or in fact separable, because I think there's a causal relationship between them. That's one of the things that my book argues. There is an extraordinary loftiness to American idealism, right? That's the dream, the great aspiration, the self-conscious sensibility of American exceptionalism. And then, like any other country, the nation's kind of a mess. So the gap between the lofty idealism and the political reality is in some ways wider in the United States, not because the United States is worse off, but because the ambition is so high, right? But the ambition and the reality are related to one another historically. So, for instance, when I was a kid and I was studying American history in school, we very much read the story of the dream. And then every once in a while, maybe once every couple of chapters of the book, there'd be a little paragraph that would say, oh, but, there was still slavery then, or oh, but women didn't yet have the right to vote, or oh, but Native American lands had been seized. But that was just a kind of like in a parenthesis on to one side. But the main plot was the story of the dream. I just don't think analytically that makes any sense. That's not how a dream works, even, right? So it is, in fact, the conquest of those lands. It is the enslavement of those people that makes possible the giant intellectual revolution that leads to the founding of the United States, which is the idea that people are sovereign. We have natural rights. We determine our own government. We have to consent to be governed. These ideas, which had been kind of kicking around England and kicking around in the Enlightenment, become reified in the United States only because of the startling reality of what it is to deprive other people of those very things, right? Like, they become things when you're taking them away from other people. And then the thingness of those rights is what the nation is founded on. So, you know, when Martin Luther King talks about the promissory note, the check that he can cash in, that promissory note, that's him saying, yeah, you got this idea from us. Like, it was enslaved people saying, you have no right to our bodies and our labor and our lives because we have natural rights to who we are. That's what makes possible the founding truths of the United States, right? So it's not someone else's check. It's all of our checks, right? Like, so that, I think, is what this reckoning is about now. And it's a painful one for many Americans because so much of American life is organized to make it very difficult for people to see other people's lives, to really reckon with. It remains a very racially segregated society. We are now separated geographically by our political affiliations. There was this big kind of geographical sorting that happened in the 1970s and 80s, where people who have one political sensibility live in certain cities and towns and states and counties and neighborhoods, and people with a different one live somewhere else. So we have a kind of ideological segregation that makes it very difficult to move forward politically. But one way that segregation works is that some people believe in the dream and some people only see the nightmare. And what's important to recognize is they're the same thing.
One thing that always intrigued me is how the United States has sort of claimed possession over certain terms like happiness, dream, using these literary, poetic words in political language. That is, injecting an element of imagination and desire in, so on the other hand, I've always also wondered, that is, you know, the pursuit of happiness is a very, very lonely enterprise, Not even in the worst parts of North Korea is there a law against trying to be happy. The point is, who is in charge of creating the context in which you can be? You can try to be happy. And in a way, I've been thinking of the parallelism and differences between this frame of words, the pursuit of happiness, and the Article 3 of the Italian Constitution that says that it is a duty of the state, of the Republic. It's not just it's a duty of the Republic to remove those obstacles of economic or social nature which constrain the freedom and equality of citizens, thereby impeding the full development of the human person. When you talk about impeding the full development of the human person, it's such an abstract sociological, psychological language that, of course, nobody knows Article 3 of the Constitution. Everybody knows about the pursuit of happiness. On the other hand, this is why we have a national health system.
Yeah.
This is why we have a public school system in which public schools are better than private schools, removing the obstacles.
Yeah.
And in a way, in the American political discourse, the equivalent was the theme of equal opportunity, which, of course, in an unequal society is hard to achieve. What remains is what makes it part. What makes a dream and the pursuit of happiness so powerful is that it entitles you to desire. It entitles you to aim. It entitles you to strive, no matter what for. But so it's a powerful personal message as opposed to a powerful social message that we send. The thing that... of course, I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan for a number of reasons, but one of them being that he makes it very clear that, yes, the dream is a curse. However, he's still going back to the river, and the river is dry, but he's still trying. Because what really counts is not the content of the dream, but the subjectivity of the dreamer and the work of the dreaming. And so, and then of course he talks about how it's no two cars in a garage dream. It's he thinks in terms of living together, and this is something, this is perhaps one of the reasons why he's so powerful, he's so popular in Europe, because he, in a way, he embodies our best values as together with. He's part Italian, you know. But I've always been wondering why is he so popular in Sweden? Precisely because somehow he bridges the gap.
Yeah.
He keeps talking about the dream, but. He talks about a dream that we can understand. And I think that partly what we need here is a bit of personal capacity of imagining desire, of imagining change singly, not just expecting it from collective action.
Yeah, you can take a little bit of our individualism and we'll take a little bit of your commitment to the public good. And then we'll both be a little bit better balanced. There's a great John Updike once said, America is a vast conspiracy to make you happy. Which I love as a kind of definition of what the United States is, right? Like that the forces that exist are actually ones that are meant to drive you to your desires. Right. And there is, and it is, I think it is to be celebrated to a limit, right? Like that spirit of pursuit and initiative and drive and desire has brought some of the most wonderful things about the United States to the United States and to the world, right? There's ingenuity and inventiveness, there's risk-taking, there's idealism, there's building things and making things, inventing things. And that is wonderful, and that is a huge piece of what I think Americans rightly understand the United States to be about. And in the best moments in American history, that individualism has been in a comfortable tension with a commitment to the collective, sharing of resources, the common good, things like public education. Since Ronald Reagan, we're tilted, right? Like since Reaganism, it's all about individualism, and any spirit of the public good becomes just a kind of voice of political dissent. But it didn't have to be that way. I mean, even cynical people will point out that happiness in the Declaration of Independence, you know, what Jefferson was cribbing from John Locke, and John Locke said, you know, the pursuit of life, liberty, and property. And yeah. Jefferson said, well, that sounds, you know, that sounds a little raw. Let's call that the pursuit of not property, but happiness. We will have happiness in our property. But that, you know, that is the sensibility, right? Like we establish a government to protect a public order, but one thing that public order is protecting is private property. Where, you know, we just kind of get out of balance all the time. Most places get out of balance all the time. I think we're pretty out of balance right now. And what's unfortunate is the way those two sensibilities now map onto our political parties, because it wasn't always the case. But right, like on the right, everything is about you pursue your own happiness and everybody else be damned. It'll be for the best. And on the left, you know, we're kind of talking about kind of a Bernie Sanders socialism, and private pursuit is to be looked down upon. That the two parties didn't always kind of sort out exactly like that. There was, I think, in previous eras of American history, much more of a kind of shared acceptance of the idea that there needs to be a balance between those two ways of thinking about what a political community is. So I don't know. I think that's a huge challenge for the country right now. We're looking at 40 years of a conservative revolution that has been telling Americans there is no public good. There is no common interest. There's no commonwealth. It's all about you, and that's the best way to go about a political community. And you don't even really need a federal government. And it's brought us to a very difficult place.
Well, in fact, I've been thinking of how Martin Luther King began with, "We have come to cash this promissory note, not I." And he talked about the beloved community. There have been exactly the people who were cut off the dream that redefined it often in terms of the common good. I'm thinking of the civil rights movement. I'm also thinking of the labor movement, of the unions, which have been sort of wiped out from the narrative of American history. And again, the labor movement, with all its contradictions, I spent a lifetime studying the coal miners. The sense that that the labor movement had of happiness was, let's get ahead together. What happened to these two powerful movements from outside the pale of the definers, to use Toni Morrison's term? The civil rights movement is we know what's happening, and the unions. If there's one thing that both major parties have in common, has been the struggle against the unions. And the disappearance of organized labor from any sort of visibility in American political discourse. I believe that Black Lives Matter, in a way, precisely because it denounces the nightmare, is one of the forces that make the quote-unquote dream a little closer. And I think we ought to think seriously about reinventing the labor movement in the new conditions and the new. But that was one of the forces that kept America together through the Great Depression, especially, but and through the hard times of the late 19th century. So that is one of the things that are missing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree about that, and I think the you know, why the Republicans, who for a long time were the party of business, you know, were anti-labor, made a certain amount of political sense. The Democratic Party's complete abdication of unions and of working people broadly was basically political suicide. So, you know, it leaves you where it leaves you. But one of the things that was so important about the civil rights movement was its moral authority. And, you know, that we was a Christian we. I mean, it was a Christian movement. It was a moral crusade in the very best sense that asked, you know, that demanded that the state recognize the equality of all people in the eyes of God, right? Like that's a longstanding tradition in American history, is in spite of our separation of church and state, is the infusion of a kind of Christian sensibility of the equality of all people to our social protest movements. And I think you see, you know, that is one way to think about Black Lives Matter. It doesn't self-consciously identify itself in any way as a Christian movement, but it is a moral crusade, and it is the moral authority of that movement that I think has spoken to so many people. I think the same could be said for Me Too as a movement, but I do think there needs to be another step beyond Black Lives Matter and Me Too, or, you know, the resurgence of unions, because I don't think the Occupy movement was that. That is about political community. That is not, that is less about, like, we are the people who don't have a voice and now we have a voice and here's what we have to say to you. That's important. But I think there needs to be a reconstituting the political community move that has to happen. And that was always, you know, the classic part of the civil rights movement, that was always its commitment. That was King's liberalism. And people would say, and certainly Black nationalists at the time said, that's not going to work. Like that, you can't, like, liberalism will not deliver justice. And that remains a criticism. Like that's kind of where things are very fiercely bound up. You know, can liberalism really deliver racial justice and real genuine political equality? It's hard to see how that can happen, given the corruptions of our political system at the moment, the crisis of journalism in particular, the role of social media. There's just the idea of liberalism is people can have an argument, and the people who have the best evidence will win the argument, and therefore politics will always become more and more fair. That deal only works when the argument can be had on a fair field. And when you have people spending huge amounts of money to direct specific messages that they've paid for, it's not really a fair field anymore. So how to restore the terms in which our democracy works is I think a big question. We just had, maybe 2 weeks ago, we had congressional hearings where the heads of Facebook, Google, Amazon, what's the other one? And Apple. Yeah, we're all brought before Congress because there were these antitrust hearings. But very few people ask questions about the manipulation of information. Mm-hmm. Facebook has still not been held accountable for basically destroying journalism, for undertaking to distribute information with no regard to ethics or political consequences. So there's a series of obstacles toward working our way through this moment.
Well, one thing about the current crisis of truth of information is that it's global and worldwide, and but because a lot of this is centered in the United States, what happens in the United States becomes absolutely crucial. On the other hand, the European Union has a responsibility because it hasn't done anything to, you know, restore some kind of credibility in the flow of information. On the other hand, working as I do in with oral histories, I never thought that there were such a thing as people who didn't have a voice. You know, there's a famous essay by Gayatri Spivak who says, "Can the subaltern speak?" Well, I personally even heard them sing. The problem is not that they don't have a voice. The problem is nobody is listening. And this this is important because it turns the table on the it's not just the marginals, the subalterns' responsibility to speak. They've been doing this all their lives, all their history. It's the ruling classes, it's the elites, it's the system, a responsibility to open up and listen. And this is not, this has not been happening, except in devious certain. I believe that without Occupy Wall Street, we wouldn't have had Bernie Sanders, and without Bernie Sanders, we wouldn't have Kamala Harris. And it's compromise after compromise after compromise, but a compromise means that there are two voices, that there are two subjects. And I think the grassroots movements are having an impact. And this is one thing that's absolutely missing on this side of the ocean. There's nothing comparable to Occupy, to Black Lives Matter. There are, I mean, for one thing, we do have occasional attempts, and there's a growing movement to organize the migrant workers from Africa and Eastern Europe into unions. There's a basic difference. They have no political rights. They're not citizens. We are in a situation where a sizable chunk of the working class has no political rights, cannot vote. And whereas in the United States, there's a serious effort to deprive Black people, working people, poor people of the vote. Here, we don't need to do that. We just have to keep rejecting their citizenship rights. And in this sense, in spite of the tragedy of what's going on in the United States, and I'm thinking especially of the pandemic, the way it's been handled, from that point of view, the United States is ahead of us, you know, because people are in the streets, and here we're just talking.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. And I think it is in many ways a very exciting and promising moment here. But I also do think it's very difficult in the long run to sustain that kind of a social movement without significantly reimagining public culture. And so like one of the reasons I wrote this book in the way I did, and it very much, you know, incorporates the sensibilities and commitments of oral history, is it's a political history with some very big political ideas in it, but the way that I wrote the book is to embody those ideas in people, ordinary people who express them, who, you know, women and people of color and indigenous people who are generally left out of American history in any meaningful way. And we have a public history here that is largely, you know, a bunch of a very particular group of older white men who are really interested in the founding fathers and the presidents. And when you have a history that looks like that, you can have people in the streets, but until you rewrite the history and involve the history, involve the people in the story of the nation, it's very difficult to sustain that. So I do think it's really, really, really important to look at not just who are your politicians, but who are your storytellers, right? So, you know, all those people that you, whose stories, you know, you're chronicling, doing oral histories, mm-hmm. you need to hear those stories. Those stories need to be in books. They need to dramatically change how we picture the history of the nation, because then there's a new way to go forward.
And I think we're being signaled that more or less our time is up.
Okay.
I would only like to add a question to, don't we need a different public school system to tell that story? Because a lot of the ways in which, you know, a particular version of this, of history has been, has become common sense is through the, through school textbooks and through the teaching. And I think, and this applies, I think, on both hands. We need to invest not just money, but ideas into the public school system, because that's the main channel in which the narrative of history is being channeled.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think school, you know, we have amazing public school teachers. They don't have the resources to do this kind of work. They don't have the books to do this kind of work. They can't get their kids out and do what needs to be done, doing oral histories in their neighborhoods, the kind of teaching that would really break open the story of America. So there's nothing that we need more urgently, aside from a vaccine. Anyway, it's really been lovely to speak with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I hope we stay in touch in other ways. Grazie di essere stati con noi e spero che questa cosa serva a qualcosa, ci aiuti un po' tutti a ragionare. E ancora una volta grazie agli organizzatori del festival e arrivederci.